Of retired boxer Ray Boom Boom Mancini, Mark Kriegel writes, "Public adulation was his nourishment." But Ray Mancini was not just chasing adulation when he first began to box. He was chasing the title his father had never had the opportunity to win. Mark Kriegel, the author of The Good Son, The Life of Ray Boom Boom Mancini, joins me from NPR West in Los Angeles. Welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. Glad to be here.
Tell us a little bit about Ray Mancini's drive to achieve what he and you call redemption for his father.
His father was a lightweight contender back in the early 1940s, before the Second World War, when essentially there were three sports in America. There was baseball, there was horse racing, and there was boxing. And his father came out of Youngstown, Ohio, and fought a number one contender in 1941, was on the wrong end of a disputed decision. He then goes off to war, where he's shot up pretty bad in France, and he's never the same. As a kid growing up in Youngstown, Ray goes through his father's scrapbook, and he seizes on a photograph of his father that was taken about 1940, 41 again. And the father is pretty beat up. His eye is closed. There's blood on his lips. And he decides, I'm going to redeem my dad. I'm going to win the title. He couldn't. And he does.
Was it that father-son subplot that made Ray Mancini such a draw in the ring, or would he have been a great draw without it?
The father-son story was at the center of the love affair that people had with Ray. There's a brief moment in American life between 81 and 82 where the public, the guy in the street, doesn't really make the distinction between Boom Boom Mancini and Rocky Balboa. He was constantly, you know, he was constantly bombarded with questions. Hey, when are you going to kick Mr. T's ass? So he was demographically perfect. This is the first term of Reagan, set against an industrial recession in America. The steel mills, and Youngstown is nothing if not a steel town, were going bust. And Ray was the righteous son of the entire Rust Belt. There was the element of ethnicity. He was, for lack of a better term, and Ray would argue about this, seen as a great white hope. One of the things I think it's difficult for younger sports fans or even fight fans to understand is that in the early 1980s, boxing was still a huge television sport. It's before ESPN, it's before the internet. The networks fed you a steady diet of fights Saturday and Sunday afternoons, and Ray became a huge draw on those days.
Of the early years of Ray Mancini's pro career, you write, and I'm quoting now, "Boxing in the 1980s was no less corrupt than it had been in the 40s and the 50s, and you go on to mention several gangsters operating at that time. But when, if ever, has boxing not been corrupt?
It's never not been corrupt. The difference between the 80s and the time that preceded it is television. And Ray, again, Ray was ideally suited for this moment, and he was a darling of the celebrity classes. Frank Sinatra sends Jilly Rizzo, his right-hand man, to Palm Springs to Ray's training camp. And Ray's a 21-year-old kid. He doesn't understand why is Sinatra's guy here, and why is he apologizing to me? Jilly says, listen, Frank wants to tell you he's sorry. And Ray says, sorry? Sorry for what? He apologizes for not being here in person. And that's how big Ray Mancini was.
Ray Mancini did eventually win the World Boxing Association Lightweight Championship. That was in 1982, and he held the title for 2 years. Would he have been better off if he had said at that point, here you go, Dad, here's the title you never had the opportunity to win, and then went on to find some less dangerous way to make a living?
No, I think that Ray was ideally suited to be a fighter, and he wasn't being reckless with his career. He hadn't stayed around too long, and I don't think that he ever envisioned staying around too long. He knew firsthand, being his father's son, how perilous it was to be a fighter. He had seen enough palookas to know better.
Some people who know nothing about the sport still have heard of Ray Mancini because in 1982 he beat up a Korean boxer named Dook-Koo Kim so thoroughly that Kim died shortly after the bout. How did that experience change Ray Mancini?
Dook-Koo Kim was a lightly regarded challenger of the WBA. And at the beginning of the 14th round, Ray does knock him out. Kim goes down and tries to raise himself up. And he gets about three-quarters of the way before collapsing. That night, just after he's been told that Kim has a subdural hematoma, a blood clot in the brain, and that it looks very, very grave, probably fatal, he goes to the Sinatra concert at Caesars, where Sinatra's been dying to introduce him. He's in sunglasses. The spotlight goes on him, and Sinatra says something like, "Ladies and gentlemen, I just saw the greatest fight I've ever seen. I've been watching the fights for 50, 60 years, and I want to introduce you to my friend, Mr. Ray Boom Boom Mancini." So he gets up and he gives like the nightclub wave, and he's thinking, "I'm a fraud. I've hurt a guy." And there's an enormous rush of guilt over the next weeks and months that Ray has.
I'm curious about Ray Mancini's health today and his prospects for going forward, and also whether he held on to enough of the money that he made so that he's secure.
Yeah, he's doing well. I would consider him, certainly by boxing standards, a very happy ending. I know him well. We're friends. We go out to dinner regularly. Me, him, and the actor Ed O'Neill, who was like his guy from Youngstown. We go to a joint in a strip mall in Santa Monica. He pays most attention right now to his youngest son's basketball career. He's solvent. For boxing, it's a startlingly happy ending.
Mark Kriegel is the author of The Good Son, The Life of Ray Boom Boom Mancini. It's published by Free Press, and he joined me from NPR West. Mark, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, my pleasure.
Hurry on early, hurry on home. Boom Boom Mancini's fighting Bobby Chacon.
You're listening to Only a Game.